The part of the Masechta that we're doing is really composed of two parts that we're going to focus on. If someone told you that you were learning the third parak of Ksubos, and you just took a quick look at the Mishnayos, you would figure out sort of half of Leishman. And that's the dinim, as I mentioned before, of Ones, Mefata, and Motzi Shemra. Okay, three parashiyos in the Torah, which we're going to spend a couple of days sort of analyzing before we look at what Chazal had to say. And I want to talk about why in a moment. And then there's another part of this parak, which is parak kamlei b'derabamineh. For those of you who are not familiar with the expression, kamlei b'derabamineh means that in judicial settings, when you perform an action which creates dual liability, let's say the death penalty and financial liability, you burn down someone's house on Shabbos. I always like to say, if you're a Talmud Chacham and you're going to burn down someone's house, you might consider doing it on Shabbos because you'll be chayv nisa, but you'll be patur from paying. Okay? And if there's no beis din to kill you, then you're patur from paying. Anyway, even if the beis din could theoretically find, you know, but mima'anash yudin emmanos, they can't because you're patur. Because of kam lebe the rabbi. But that's what kam lebe the rabbi is. And it's sufficient to give him the greater punishment. Now, there is a very long sugya in the Bavli, and interestingly enough, which we do in Shir, Yerushalmi as well, there's a long sugya in Yerushalmi. And for those of you who are a little bit familiar with having learned Yerushalmi, when you get long sugyas in the Bavli, they're often not found in the Yerushalmi, because the Yerushalmi is, I don't want to say closer to Pshuto Shel Mishnah, but it tends to have less of the elaborate, you know, sugyas that are the hallmark of the Talmud Bavli. The reason why it's also found in the Yerushalmi is because the topic of Kamle B'derabamineh is already in the Mishnah, and it's a perfectly natural outgrowth of the first two sets of Mishnayos in the Perek. The Narosh Shechayev Amaleim Knas, and the Narosh that you're potter on Knas, because the Mishnah itself will say that Haba'al Bito is potter from the Knas because Mishayev B'nafsha. And the truth is, the concept of Kamle B'derabamineh is almost explicit in the Torah, even though it's not. Right, it's almost explicit in the Torah, because the Torah says that if you strike a pregnant woman, v'lo yeh ason, and the standard reading of Chazal, v'lo yeh ason means what? Anyone know? Chinatzon Hashem v'nagufu isha harava yatzu yadeha v'lo yeh ason, anoshi anesh kasher yashis alav bal ha'isha, v'nasan b'flilin, v'im ason yeh v'nasatan nefesh tachas nefesh. So what is an ason? No. That's the Yatsu Yilodeh. What is Ason Yitzi? If she dies. Okay? So the assumption of the way Chazal read the Pesukim, which is, I think, Pshuta Shemekra, as a person tries to kill his friend and instead strikes a pregnant woman. Now, you could read he's not trying to kill his friend, trying to strike his friend, and accidentally hits the pregnant woman and kills her. But the Chazal assume that it's a case of Niskavein Lahara Gazeh Bahara Gazeh. There happens to be a machlokas whether Menasatam Nefesh Tachas Nefesh, in this case, is Mamish or Mamish. Okay, it's an interesting machlokas. I don't know that we're going to deal with it. But the implication, the way Chazal read it, it's not black and white, is that if there's no Ason, then you pay money. But Vim Yeh Ason, well, what happens? So, in other words, you pay money to the husband for the loss of the Vlados. But if you kill the woman, the implication is what? That you don't pay money. But now you could read it as, by the way, but in Asonia, and if there's an Ason, on top of that you have to pay the money to compensate the husband for the fetuses, or the fetus, you also kill him for killing the woman. You could have read it that way. That's not how Chazal would read it. But Chazal's reading is certainly very, as plausible as Pshuta Shel Mikra, so it's almost beferish in the Torah, the idea of Kamlei B'derabamineh when it comes to Misa and Mama. So because of that, because this comes up in the Mishnayos, that's why it's found in the Yerushalmi as well. A very parallel, similar, with differences, sugya that we're going to do in the Yerushalmi as well. So really, in terms of lamdos, that's a major, major topic come later to the Rabbi Yudeh. I'm sure there are places, yeshivas and shirim, that could spend 2 years doing the topic. I mean, in all its reaches and shas. It's a really, really interesting, philosophically and jurisprudentially, it's a very interesting issue. Outside of that, we're going to focus on, you know, sort of the major issues, which we're starting with, at least at the way beginning, which is Ones, Mefata, and if we get to Motzi Shemra, I don't know that we will. Okay, so now I want to talk a little bit about the Psukim. I asked you to come into Shir with 10 questions. There was one question, which was not a textual question, which I'm not going to answer right now. I'll try not to. I'll restrain myself and not answer right now, but I hope that every one of you asks the question. I hope you ask the question because I know my one of my 14-year-old nephews, who's a very sensitive neshama, who is entering high school, and I think they're doing, I don't know, ksubas or something, he had to learn this parak, was deeply, 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 deeply troubled. And I hope that one of your 10 questions, you can have more than 10 questions, by the way, but one of your 10 questions would have been this particular question. And what's that question? No, you're jumping way too far ahead. Way too far, because that's a question of what. It's certainly not the din. It's not the way Chazal read, that's for sure. Not the psukim hold that way either. It's a separate question. Daniel?
Why is it only speaking about rape cases of a virgin?
Okay, that's sort of a very narrow subset of the larger question. Yitzi?
Why is there basically a minor punishment for a major crime?
Yeah. I mean, you're talking about, and it's an interesting question. I'm going to throw out only one more statement about this. I'm going to repeat his question. I'm going to throw out one more statement, and it's maybe a little provocative, but you'll have a chance to sort of let the statement stew a little bit. Yitzi said, how can what seems to be such a major crime get off with such a light punishment? You rape a woman, and you pay a 50, it might have been a lot of money, you pay a 50 shekel, you know, fine, and that's, you know, if you don't marry her, right? I mean, some of you are wondering, like, what woman would want to marry such a guy? Okay, but that you would basically pay, you get off what seems to be such a light punishment. I'm going to ask you the following question. If you cut off someone's arm, if you maim them in some form or fashion, what is your punishment? You pay money. You compensate for damages. Now, we'll talk about in a moment when you read the psukim, what is this 50 shekel? I already used the wrong term. I already followed Chazal's lead. I called it a fine. Okay? You call it a knas. Right? But a 50 shekel payment, let's assume that might have been economic damages of some kind. Right? Right? Because clearly here, if a woman, you rape a woman who's a basula, and then your question is a correct one also. It's really the corollary, okay? And if she's not a basula, right? If she's a basula, you understand what the economic loss is. Now, there's a woman who was a basula versus not being a basula. The mice of what's really the difference, right? She's going to get married at some point near Hashem anyway, and so she's not going to be a basula soon anyway. So what's the difference, right? So your question is just a sort of a subset of the larger question. Like, that's what you get away with, but ask the question, you injure someone in a different fashion, right? And when you cut off someone's, if you cut off someone's limb, if you maim them in some form or fashion, even if life goes on and they can do what they do or whatever it is that they do as a substitute, it's not like I destroyed your property, right? It leaves a lasting emotional impact upon a human being.
That's why you have violence.
That's financial compensation.
No, but you're financial compensation for emotional
okay.
harm.
Okay. I agree that that's part of it, but still, so you're saying basically when it comes to rape, you would put a price on it, how much the emotional trauma is and so on, and assuming 50 kesef, and that's all.
He marries her, that's the parallel. He atones for the damage by ensuring that she's still alive.
Well, that might, I got it. But nonetheless, but if she doesn't want, let's assume that she doesn't, I mean, let me take the next step, because I think Danny said it, which is, who said you force it, that, he marries her. Did you hear a comment? Now, let's say she doesn't want to marry him by onus. Right? Again, I'm already filling in things that maybe are not beferish, but by utfasa, when he grabs her, which certainly seems to be a case of rape. So you force him, he must marry her, right? What if she doesn't want to? Now, by the other case, by mefate, so there, at least there's a notion of ma'enya ma'ena via the sitala. Now, doesn't say about her, but do you think it's conceivable the Torah believed that she would have to marry him against her will? Why not?
You can't marry against your will.
Okay, but I'm not asking whether Kiddushin are binding technically, but by ones, Lamaisa, she wants to marry him, you still need Kiddushin. Right? In other words, there's a mitzvah of the Torah, he must marry her. If you look at the Rambam, and he counts in the mitzvos, in Hilchos, the Rambam has, by the way, one small book, set of halachos within a book, Hilchos Nara Besula, okay, which deals with these three topics. It's like three prakim. It's in Ishus. So the Rambam counts. He's supposed to marry her, and it's not granted. It's not automatic. But why can't it be that if he agrees to, why can't that be, Akiva?
Well, the phraseology analogy implies he has to marry her, not the other way around.
Okay, but it doesn't say anything about refusal there. The Torah says, well, it doesn't even say that, by the way. It says, well, no si el isha. You see?
You're
a kal v'chomer, but maybe not. The Gemara will talk about that issue. There's an achlokas hamorayim, but one of the responses is so intuitive. Daniel?
Well, I'd also point out that in the previous case in Shemot Krakow, in the previous Sukkot on Tetvav and Tetzayin, it's actually the consent of the father.
But it doesn't say anything about that bionis, right?
It doesn't.
Right, it doesn't. Chazal will talk about that.
Would really, I'm just saying that it's trying to draw a sharp distinction between the two cases.
Maybe. If you read Parshas Rashi and Parshas Mishpatim, it's not Rashi, it's quoting Medrash Halacha, the Mechilta. Chazal always do this. I don't think it's only between Dvarim and other Svarim, but often you have parallels between Dvarim and other Svarim. Chazal harmonize. They do this all the time because they assume that there's no conflict, reasonably so, between the two. So here, Chazal, one component of studying this question is the harmonization of Chazal do or don't do between Ones and Mefateh. For example, I'll flip the question on its head. Does a Mefateh have to marry her?
It
depends how you read Mahoyim Harena Lolisha. If that's a mitzvah, the answer is yes.
Yeah, because then why would it say
you already probably learned the Mishnah, so you know what Chazal say about it. Read them, by the way, and I just want to add, I believe I put it on the Makaris, I think the Mechilta the Rashbi says he doesn't have a choice by Mefateh.
Well, is it kind of like Yibum? Is it that's...
No. Well, explain, the answer is no, but what do you mean?
Meaning... It's incumbent upon him, but if she rejects him, then...
No. Yibum is completely different because Yibum is what we have, what's called a Zika. There's already a quasi-marital bond between them, which neither one is totally free. She has to get him to get Chalitza. But here, there is no... After he rapes her, at least in Chazal's view, there is no bond whatsoever. Right? In other words, it's like Znus, where there's no bond of Ishus whatsoever. Now, and if he has to marry her, he has to marry her.
But isn't there...
No, because it requires. We have a lot of married people, even from Jews, unfortunately. If Bia was enough without Beferish Kiddushin and Adim and intent for Kiddushin, right? So let's just leave it that. No, it requires. You know, Rav Moshe and Rav Heineman might have. Rav Moshe and. Rehaken, thank you. Might have argued about whether civil marriage and maybe kabbalah marriage. Civil marriage was considered halachic marriage, and thank God for Moshe's opinion, which was sumach upon that it's not. But that's when there's sort of intent for marriage. That's not in various contemporary forms of I won't even say things in polite company. Yes, Itzi.
I don't understand the halachim. You know why this woman would want to. Be married to her rapist.
Okay, so I'll say two words to you. I'll say four words to you. Number one, Stockholm syndrome, and number two, battered women. Okay, and if you just explore them, I'm not.
I mean, Stockholm syndrome is an actual thing.
Yes.
Like they would actually.
Yes.
But it'll have to be over a time.
Guys, you have to remember something. You are living now in the 21st century with a whole set of cultural assumptions that you think that everybody would think that way. Okay? And what you have to realize is that is simply not true. The world thought a lot differently 30 years ago, and then 100 years ago, and then 500 years ago, and 3,000 years ago. Things that you take for granted, and I was hinting to this before in my comment, about drawing the parallel of God the arm. Don't assume that your way of looking at things is the same way that people would have looked at them. Don't assume that part of the impact of any kind of injury, including rape, part of it is what I'll call cultural. Just as an interesting halachic statement, boshes is considered a knas, in the Rambam Zohar. It's a very strange position. So the question that's asked is, and the Rambam deals with this, why then, when someone is modeh that he injured someone else, do I have to pay boshes? There's normally only to pay mamon, you don't have to pay knas. And the Rambam has a lashon where he says that when the testimony is given in court, that's when the person experiences the boshes. In other words, part of the boshes is socially experienced. In other words, so pain and suffering, certain kinds of pain and suffering, emotional anguish, is culturally constructed. I'm not saying it's not real for those who live in a certain culture, but you have to remember that piece. But I still, before I take your question, I keep wishing that's on somebody else, I'm waiting to hear the obvious. Why can't it be? Why can't it be that she has no choice in the matter? Or she or her father. Let's assume for the moment the father and daughter are one corporate entity, okay? Which is its own set of questions, but accept that for the moment. Why not, Nathan?
It's like she's being punished twice.
Okay,
number
so
one, she has to be raised.
So what? It's a machlok.
Yes.
Well, okay.
Forced again.
As for Shimon,
the rule exists for her benefit.
Okay, you're coming with a certain set of assumptions. They are not disagreeing, but
you get a weird legal loophole inside saying, "I want to marry a person I just raised."
Okay, so that's a great literature way of framing it. And the way one of the Amoraim says it, I think it's Abaye Rabbi, it's a machlokes. One of them says, "Shelo yehi chotei niskar." That a guy sees a woman, you know, and decides, I want to marry him. She doesn't want to marry him, right? So, okay, well, I'll go rape her, and then she has to marry me. That's ridiculous. Now, one of the comments I have here, those of you who take an intro to Bible, this should not be anything unusual. You might have even read this passage. Those of you who haven't yet, it may be a little surprising to you, but on the last source on the sheet, I took something from ancient Near Eastern law, which happens to come from a parallel period to which the Torah was given. And it's interesting to look at the law of rape there. They don't talk about seduction. And there you see that, putting aside the question of daughter and father, you see that of course you can't, no one's going to force, you know, he might be forced to marry her. She or the father are not going to be forced to accept him as a husband. So, what's that?
The wife gets thrown in there.
Yeah. Oh, so this is a fascinating law, because those who take intro to Bible understand this. It just fits into, even if you didn't see this, it fits into a context. The notion of vicarious punishment in ancient Eastern law. You have, by the way, traces of this in Chazal, in a Gemara in the Sanhedrin, I think, by the Sodom and Amorah. So, you know, if someone injured his friend's wife, his fellow's wife, and caused her a miscarriage, so he had to sleep with her until she got her pregnant again. Right? That's sort of I don't know that Chazal were aware of ancient Near Eastern law, but it expresses a twisted version of the same sentiment, right? You kill my daughter, so I kill your daughter, right? That isn't the way the Torah works. The Torah is lo yumsu avos albanim vanim lo yumsu avos ish mechatel yumasu. One of probably the central principles of halachic jurisprudence is we don't believe in vicarious punishment. But I just point to that particular law, because you see even there, there's no hava mina that the rapist gets to marry her when she doesn't want to marry him, or she or her father. Again, she may not have an independent voice, but that's not a consideration. And the simple reason is shelo yehechote niskar, right? You can't reward that kind of behavior and saying, okay, now you raped her, okay, so you get the marriage if you want. It's like, no. Akiva, your question.
Yes, with regard to the earlier point about economic damages, the same as any other limb, if we're going to throw out the emotional aspect and just say from an economic point that he's fined 50 keseth, mm-hmm. The difference in the ksuba is 100. Why wouldn't he have to pay that?
All right, so that raises a different issue that the Ramban, takes Rashi to task for. Let's assume for the moment, it's a machlokas, but let's assume for the moment that there is no such thing as ksuba midaraisa. It's a machlokas here, Rashi and Ramban. And again, it's not necessarily Rashi's shita, it may just be his perish on chumash, but what is mohar yim harena lo disha? Pshuto shemikra, the Ramban is almost certainly correct. There's the idea of Rashi is coming off of a different comment, kemohar habsulos, which Chazal say, kama resh. That's a remez for ksuba min haTorah. But whether ksuba exists min haTorah or not is a long-standing machlokas haTanoim, machlokas haAmoraim. I don't remember if there are any Rishonim who paskin. Well, there is a machlokas haRishonim as well. I don't know if the text of the ksuba is still ringing in your head, but you might recall, and some of you have been Baruch Shem in many weddings this past week, that you read here in the ksuba, V'yahidni lichi mo'ar b'sulaychi ksaf zuzei mosam. The Chazi Lichi Midoraisa. Rabbeinu Tam, I think, used that as proof that we pass in Ksuba Doraisa, but others say, not so. That's a whole discussion. But the bottom line is, let's assume for the moment, Al Pipshuta Shemekra, this does not actually refer to Akiva Ksuba. This is something, a payment of going into marriage, rather than, and there's no Ksuba, and there's not necessarily any Ksuba being spoken about or involved in any point. Josh?
My question is that why Na'ara Betula? What's the difference in status of the Na'ara? Is she just like the blank slate, that there's nothing that would be exterior to her within rape, meaning like it's not sleeping with another man's wife, and
Okay, someone want to answer that? I'll stop you right there. Someone want to answer that question? Yes, Akiva?
I may be completely wrong, but polygamy was acceptable?
No, 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 but he said something else, and not another man's wife.
It's another man's wife. It's killing your rabbi, and you get killed.
Well, no, that hurts. You're right on some level, assuming that she was still a basula. How do you know it's not a case of another man's wife? Daniel? Sherlo Arasa, it says that. Right? Ibn Rashbam or Ibn Ezra, Rashbam points out already, Shim Arasa Chayiv Skila Kedachsib Mishneh Torah. Right?
The question isn't about why it's not a married woman, but why is it not a Basula?
What's the difference?
Okay, so I purposely interrupted your question because I didn't want to answer that part. So you gave me enough rope to hang you with. You asked the question, what if she were married? So that was easy to deal with. I did understand that piece of the question. So I want to, before we go on there, I wanted that question to be the obvious question, which is, how is this punishment commensurate with a crime that we consider such an enormous crime against the human being? The Mishnah at the end of Horios states that when you have, this raises its own set of questions, so please do not open this Pandora's box. I shut it as soon as I open, shut the can before any of the other worms crawl out. But the last Mishnah Horios that speaks about Kedima, who comes first in different situations. So one of them is how Ish Kodem Isha Latzala. So if you have to save one, who gets saved first is the man. But if they're Omdin L'Kala, in other words, if they're B'Shevi, if it's not about life-saving, but redeeming them from captivity, you redeem the woman first, Sheboshta Meruba, because she is likely to be raped, and therefore that degree of shame outweighs his being stuck in prison. And then they say, but if they're both Omdin L'Kala, that they'll rape either one, then he comes first because his shame is greater, which is definitely a social construction, which is probably true today as well. You can tell that, I think you should be able to tell that to many women and they wouldn't find that surprising or offensive, right? In other words, there is a degree of social shame that's associated with it, and to a large extent that's what it is, and it's very real, and for us it's very hard to understand that can simply be compensated with or punished with simply a monetary payment. So that's a question that I will come back to at some point, probably even this week, and you can push me to come back to it, but I think that's a very important question. And I think it's a more important question for something that I don't have anything in mind and I'm not going to talk about right now, but I think it's important to state in the current cultural climate generally, in the Orthodox world, is that it's legitimate to ask those questions. Not always do we have answers, and not all answers are really acceptable answers within the traditional framework, but it is legitimate to ask the questions. And on some level, to me, it's foolish when you don't ask the questions. To pretend they don't exist is like an ostrich, the proverbial ostrich with its head in the sand. Okay, the questions are real questions, and it's okay to ask them. We don't always have great answers, and some answers might be considered out of bounds, but to ask the questions is certainly legitimate, if not necessary. David?
To take your comparison seriously, then why is it set 50 shekels sort of thing? Why is it not something that we have to pay him according to the cultural harm that's done to her?
Okay, so if you assume...
I mean, Boshe, if we want to compare it to Boshe, we compare it to how embarrassing it is.
Okay, so I'll answer your question. I can answer your question either as a scholar or as a yeshiva bacher. Which one would you like?
Well.
As a yeshiva bacher, I'll answer your question. You read the Mishnah. This is just a knas. That's above Boshes, Pagam, and Tzar.
Okay.
So in other words, he absolutely pays...
What about Boshes is knas, though?
But it's legal categorization. When I say Boshes is not a fixed knas. It varies based upon the Mavayish and the Mizvayish.
Then why wouldn't it be the same thing as Boshet?
No, this 50 silver says as follows. This 50 shekel is, no matter how much your social shame amounts to, and the Nezek, and the Tsar, on top of that, once you calculated that independently, you pay 50 silver on top of that.
Okay.
That's the way that's the Yeshiva Bacher's answer. The scholar's answer might be is that 50 shekelim would have been what would have been a typical value encompassing all that 3,000 years ago.
I'm saying, wouldn't the Torah, assuming all that...
So now you're asking the question, which is the difference between the way Chazal deal with things in Pshuta Shomikra, when you pay Shloshim Shkalim for the Eved,
yeah.
When you pay shloshim shkalim for the eved, the shor shenagach es ha'eved, the shor muad. So why is that a fixed value? Why does it vary based upon the value of the eved? The answer to that question is that if you look in the first half of the second, the pshuto shemikra answer, if you look in the second half of the second millennium BCE, around the time Torah was given, the typical cost of a slave was 30 silver. If you happen to look in the first half of the second millennium BCE, the time when Yosef was sold for 20 silver, the typical price of a slave was 20 silver. So pshuto shemikra might argue that that is the full encompassing thing. That is not how Chazal treat it. For reasons that the Gemara will talk about. The Gemara asks the Kasha. The Gemara says, how do you know 50 isn't everything? That's the Gemara talks about it. Adin?
This question might not make sense because the two might be in totally separate categories, but Chazal mentioned that there are ranks of punishment. Skila is the worst type of SO. Where?
Skila, Srifa, Herik, and Henek, though we pass him. The only nafkamina for Psak is, how do you say it in the Al-Khaitz? I think Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai in his Al-Khaitz said, Srifa, Skila, Henek, Herik. Okay, yeah.
So where does monetary knafu depend on how much money it is compared to malchus?
Excellent question. I have a question for you. A person comes up to a Jew and says to him, worship this Avodah Zarah, I'm going to kill you. So what is that Jew supposed to do?
He's supposed to die.
Okay. What if he says, I'm not going to kill you, I'm going to torture you? What's the din?
Tortured,
the Gemara on Daf Lamed Vav, I believe, states, "In mole magdua lachanani mishal vazaria habapochen letzalma." If instead of throwing them into the fire, they had instead chosen to beat Nagdim Malkos, it's Nagdusa, beat Hanani mishal vazaria, they would have worshipped the tzelv.
They should have.
But that's an interesting question. It could be that there is a shita that exists. I learned this from Dr. Berger many, many, many eons ago when I took his course in Revel, more years ago than I care to admit. he may have to mention the shita Mikubetzes, who says that torture you don't have to be Moser Nefesh for. Tosus raises the question, but doesn't.
Where is this?
Well, I think it's Lamed Vav, Tav Lamed Vav Beis, I believe. It's in our parak. Gemara talks about that, and when they have different drushes that come on the rabbi, they for Misa and Malkos, Malkos and Mammon, Misa and Mammon, and so on and so forth. That's where they talk about it, because they're discussing exactly that question, what is the relative nature of punishment. It's generally assumed that Misa is worse than Mammon. As you know, that Chazal realized that there are some individuals who are psychologically inclined to think the other way. That's why the Torah had to say, V'ahavta Hashem v'chol levavcha, v'chol nafshecha, v'chol me'odecha. Because yesh lecha avadam shechav v'lav gufa mono, and yesh lecha avad shemono chav v'lav migufa. Rav Chaim Yivalashda, I believe, points out, though, I think I heard this from Rav Shechter, that in the parsha of the Tzibur, of Hayav Shemoa, it only says v'chol levavchem, v'chol nashchem, it doesn't say v'chol ma'odchem, because only individuals can be warped to value their money more than their lives, but on the Tzibur, on the common level, that doesn't happen. Okay, they never saw some modern Orthodox Jewish communities, but that's a separatist. Okay, fine. Anyway, fine. Also in the New York metropolitan area, how's that? I can only speak to the regions in which I have more familiarity with. That's only tongue in cheek.
So Malkos and
Misa. So the Gemara, Malkos and Misa, we get Misa over Malkos.
Malkos and Knas.
Well, Knas is not. Knas is the nature. Is the jurisprudential nature of the money that's being paid with ramifications in certain areas like Modav Knas and so on. But that doesn't impact the. Impacted the punishment on the person being punished. And it's $50 $50.
So
whether it's Tashlumen or whether it's Knat, whether it's Mammon or Knat.
So Mammon and Malkos?
So that's a large part of the discussion. What takes priority over the other? And then there are certain exceptions, because there are cases we know what the din is. Right? For example, if I strike a person, okay, here's the way it works. If you're going to hit a person, hit him really hard. Why? Because if you hit him really hard, you're likely to do a shabbat kutah's worth of damage, and you have to pay whatever you damage you do. But if you really mess things up and you only hit him a little less pachas mishavah prita, since it's not mamo, you don't get mamo, but instead you get malchus for lo Yosef ten Yosef, right? So really, it reminds one of the story of the Gemara of the Gemara is talking about Boshes in the 8th parak in Bava Kamma, and some guy who was a public menace. He did something to Mirvai or something like that. He flicked him on the ear or something like that. He was hired to pay Palga the Zuza. So he didn't have He only had a full zuz, so he went ahead and he flicked the guy again. And he said, here's your zuz. Okay? Stories of the Gemara. I didn't make that one up. So I think generally we consider Malkos, intuitively Malkos and Mohammed the moment, that's a question. And that is a Malkos and Mohammed both in the Bavli and Yerushalmi. Okay. Any questions, Ad Kan? If not, I would like to start to read the Psukim for a few minutes. Daniel, stop me at 2:30. We'll, you know, the general rule is if we're finished by before 2:35, we davening. Full chazar sashatz afterwards, we daven hech kedusha, so I don't make you late to class. So, but stop me by 2:30 because I need to talk for a few minutes about the end of time. I started the beginning of the year was the beginning of time, and now this year's end of time. All right, can I have a volunteer reader? Here's a story. Actually, I normally call on people to read. If you have something that makes you very uncomfortable reading in shir, if you didn't prepare, you can always take a pass. You have to swallow your medicine, you weren't prepared, and so on. If you have a discomfort in reading publicly for whatever reason, just let me know after shir, drop me an email. The purpose is not to embarrass you. I do like to keep you a little bit on your toes, but those of you who've been here know a while that, unfortunately, at some point, there's no shame in saying, sorry, can I pass today? So I do like to call you read. Reading is very, very important. So I'm happy to take a volunteer today for this particular pasuk. Adin, go ahead. All right, so let's talk about this a little bit. There's a lot to talk about here. Yifateh. What does to be mifateh mean? Mati?
Convince.
It's okay, like I like to say, I know you heard me. Like in Cal, so you get her to fill out a form, like in California or something like that. I'm sorry, only in California college campuses. So v'chi yifateh, you convince her. Okay, that's a very neutral term. Okay,
yeah,
seduce is a good word. That's a word that already starts to carry some more of the moral opprobrium attached to it. So that's a reasonable suggestion, yes?
It seems that it's an action of bending her will to something that she wouldn't want to have done otherwise. Mental coercion.
Okay. So you might say, so that raises, by the way, a fundamentally interesting question of what is the line between, I'll call it, manipulation and... And what?
No, because it's serious.
I'm letting that one go. Okay, I hope the recording didn't pick that one up. Manipulation and coercion. Okay, what's the difference between manipulation and rape? Right. In other words, it's a serious question. Now, it's an issue, as much as I may make fun of the absurdity of the California law, nothing against California. Don't read the news. It's unbelievable. Fortunately, this is a problem, but you don't have one problem. We have many problems in yeshiva. This is a problem which is virtually non-existent in yeshiva. Okay? It's hard enough to get a girl into the dormitory, and vice versa. So I don't think, I'm not telling you that it never happens. I'm sure it happens in apartments on occasion. But it's a much less prevalent problem. But anyway, but the line, in other words, what's the line between, what was the word you used?
Mental coercion.
Mental coercion, manipulation. Where does it cross from being manipulation into really being, call it, macerate? And that's a very, very unclear line. And that's one of the things, you ply someone with a drink, right? When you ply someone with a drink, it's not if they say yes, it's like they don't know what they're doing, but it means some of their mental defenses are down, right? Some of the things that they might have mixed feelings about, all of a sudden, their inhibitions are lowered, right? It's a very complicated question. Very, very complicated. So, but let's just say the law has to state at some point there is a certain point where I persuade you to do something wrong, but you're responsible. There is a point. We can debate when someone's not in the capacity, doesn't have the capacity to make a sound decision, a sound legal decision. But there is a point at which we say you are responsible for your decision. So you could say that if you want to use the term mental coercion, but up until the point that's not considered coercion, that's not considered rape. So seduce, deceive, right? Now this is an issue that Rashi and Ramban take up, right? That's really the Machlokas Rashi and Ramban. Yes, Mati?
I guess the question then becomes then, but if we're saying this is dealing with the Nara or Tana, is there any possibility of it being fully consensual?
All right, so let's step back for 1 second. One of the very interesting things about these two psukim is that they don't mention what?
No.
They don't mention an age. Now, just as a matter of halachic fact, there are three stages in...
It says Isha. So we assume when it says Isha,
no, because there's a father. There's a father involved. Remember that when you have a father midoraisa can marry off his daughter when she's a ketana, and it's a real marriage. So mahori imar lishav may mean with the father's permission, because it's implied. In fact, right. So in the next line, it's implied that the father it would have been the father who consented and the father who refuses. Now, it doesn't say the age, but halakhically speaking, there are three stages, both in men and women, in normal development. In women, most of you probably know it. It's ketana, which is up until the age of 12 years and a day. And at 12 years and a day, provided that she has the signs of puberty, what we call shtei saros, then she moves from the status of ketana to nara. It's an in-between stage. It lasts no more than 6 months, so 12 years, 6 months and a day. During that stage, for most dinim b'raisa, she's a gadola. She's full majority age. So whoever has sort of asked that question, she is considered of sound mind and body to make decisions, but she is still b'shus aviyah. During that 6 month or less period of Nara, she still has under father's control. If her father is dead, she's a free agent. She's totally in her own control. If her father once married her off before and she had Nisuin and now she got divorced or the husband died, she's in her own Rishus at that point. She could be a katana, by the way, where the father can't marry her off. And as a man marries off his daughter, and while she's a katana, that's Kiddushin Daraisa. If the husband dies or divorces her after Nisuin, Midaraisa, she can't get married until she becomes an Nara, because the father no longer, once you have Nisuin, not Erisin, Nisuin, the daughter exits the father's Rishus permanently. But if she's not an Nara yet, she's not of majority age to make her own decision, so you can't have real Kiddushin Daraisa. So a girl, after 12 years, 6 months, and a day, even though this part is not the Farish in the Torah at all, she is now a Bogeris, she's totally, completely Minat Torah on her own. A young man has three stages as well, not as well known, although my son knows that stage because he heard it many times. First stage is up until 13 years and a day. 13 years and a day, in Shtei Saros, he enters an in-between period until either 3 months pass by, or until he has Yaakov Zakana Tachton, when he has, you know, a ring of pubic hair in his private areas. The only nafgamina that I'm aware of for that particular period is that I reminded my son constantly, was I can still make you into a Ben Sora or Mora, you better watch out, okay? He's past that stage, a few years past it. So that stage in between 13 years and a day and 3 months later, or Achi Yaakov Zakana Tachton, whichever comes first, is the analog to Narus by a daughter. It just has far... It also relates to Rishus Ha'av, right? The Rishus of the parents to punish the child as a Ben Sora Amora. After that, then he's a Gadol. You know, he's a... We won't use the term Bogera. I don't think that's a term Chazal use, but he's a Gadol for all purposes. Even for Ben Sora Amora, he can no longer become a Ben Sora Amora. Yes. Akiva?
Doesn't Tzuvos also list three years old as another stage of development for a girl?
That's a physical development stage. Before 3 years and a day, you can't have Bia. Same thing for a boy. Before 9 years and a day, it's not considered Bia. But that's a physical stage. It has an occasion.
The biological thing that comes
out. Neither one makes sense. In other words, Chazal had this notion that if Bia takes place before 3 years and a day, the Besulim grow back. In fact, there's that unbelievable Yerushalmi in the Sanhedrin, which states that if she reached 3 years and a day and then the Sanhedrin turned around and was Makadish Lachod, that was Ma'aber Lashana, that will impact whether the Besulim grow back or not. Lakel Gomer Alai, I think, is the expression. But Me'apimitius, it's not true anyway. It doesn't really matter when. The hymen is a vestigial membrane from the embryonic stage, and when it's gone, it's gone. It doesn't grow. You can surgically, it can be sewn back if there are parts still intact. Something done in certain third world countries, to protect women, who, for whatever reason, aren't basulos, from families that will kill them otherwise. So there are organizations that do that, but in normal circumstances, they don't grow back. And when it comes to a boy, again, it's a halachic statement more than anything else. In other words, independent of any scientific, there is no scientific statement attached to the male thing. In fact, it's machlokas b'shamay, so 8 years in the day, 9 years in the day. That obviously Chazal could have seen from Metzius easily, that he's either capable or not capable of having a bia of some kind. But it's the halachic statement anyway. So before 9 years in the day and before 3 years in a day for a boy and for a girl, so it's not considered halachically bia for all sorts of purposes. Okay.
But then there's no sort of concept, I guess, of consent for saying if the kid's having a relationship with an older woman sort of a thing, then it's considered as if it's bia, real bia, as opposed to, let's say, rape of him.
Look, there's a separate question of whether or not something is psychologically unhealthy and so on. It's just as a halachic statement, is that if she's a married woman, and that's not her husband, that 8-year-old, so that halachically speaking, it's not adultery. It's not an act of bia. Okay. Fine. Okay, so Yifateh is a discussion in Rashi and the Ramban. Again, later in the week we'll read through the Ramban. Next, Bisula Asher Lo Orasa. We're told two details. We're not told the age, which is the interesting question. She is a Bisula. The definition of Bisula is in effect twofold halachically speaking. One definition of Bisula is a woman who has never had intercourse. The question is complicated by the fact that halacha recognizes two forms of intercourse, two forms of bia as being real bia for all things in the Torah that require bia, for losina, for adultery, for kahuna purposes, for apostling women to the kahuna. Those two forms of bia are bia kadarka and bia shalo kadarka. Bia kadarka is vaginal intercourse, bia shalo kadarka is anal intercourse. All other forms of sexual contact in halacha, they might be usur in various contexts between, two people who are not married to each other, but they are not considered halachically bia. In the context of a relationship that is prohibited, it is considered what we call losikravu, in the colloquial terms, shot negia, but in halachic terms, the violation of losikravu, but it's not, which is a machlokas or rishon, and whether it's the raisa or rabbanon, it's not something that has the status of bia for the purposes of misa, kares, malchus, and so on. I'll leave out malchus on because you might get malchus or losikravu, but it's not for bia of arayos. It's a separate isser of if it's asur min haTorah or b'drabbanon, it's an isser of losikravu. But that's one definition of Basula. The other one, which is an interesting one, it relates to the Basulim, the actual hymen, the membrane, which is normally there at birth, still from the entrance to the vaginal canal. And you can have situations where a woman who doesn't have Basulim, even though she's actually never had intercourse. It's the term that Chazal used for this is a Mugas Eitz, literally struck with a word. It means she suffered some injury. Popularly speaking, it said that certain types of physical activities can cause Nishiras HaBasulim. Horseback riding was supposedly one of them. I recall hearing a story that a certain Rabbanim in Europe when, what?
Oh yeah, it's scientifically true. It's scientifically true, I think.
Okay, so they would write down if young woman had gone horseback riding, so if an issue came up after the wedding where the Hassan claimed she wasn't a Psula, well, we know why, and so on. It's called the Mukas Eitz. For most purposes in Halacha, her status is unchanged, with the exception, perhaps, of a din that requires formal basula, which would be dinim like this, perhaps, it will be discussed, and, for example, marry a Kohen Gadol. A Kohen Hedyot doesn't have to marry a basula. He can marry even an almana, but a Kohen Gadol has to be b'hu isha v'vsula yikach, and so there's a machlokas, I believe, in Yevamos, whether or not a woman who is a basula from Bia, but she doesn't have, or basulim are not intact. I think everybody actually agrees on the Mukas Eitz. Kohen Gadol can't marry a Mukas Eitz. Yes, honey?
Doesn't a Kohen Gadol need to have a wife? At least for purposes?
When he marries her, she can't be. Yeah,
I'm saying,
when he was a Kohen Hedyot, and Ma'aris, and then he was appointed Kohen Gadol, because Marta Bas Baitus had a lot of money, and he still was Kohen Hedyot, even he still needed afterwards. As long as the Kiddushin takes place for Heter, then we don't care that her status, his status changes afterwards, her status. Obviously, it can't be that, right? In other words, she's not going to be Basula Mamela after the first time. Yes, but yes, a Kohen Gadol to the devil in Yom Kippur does require a wife. He has to be married, is the better way of putting it. Yes, Yitzi?
What's the reason that Kohen Gadol cannot marry a Mukas Eitz?
Because it says, V'hu isha v'vsuleha yikach. Because I understand her besulim, and it doesn't say who isha besula yikach, v'hu isha v'vsuleha. That's how Chazal read. That's how they read. Not during the Maisa, obviously. Josh?
What halachic status does the Jew besula?
But
does what?
The actual, I guess the signs, the physical manifestations, what halachic status does that have? Or what importance does it have otherwise?
None. I mean, other than, again, some of it, a lot of it is cultural, in the sense that there was a higher price in the ksuba attached to marry a basula.
Meaning, if she was basula, but she had mucus eggs,
right?
Would she still have the
So that's why I said, the nafkaminas aren't so broad. There's a question here. I think the Medrash Halacha says that a mukaseis, I'm sure the Gemara quotes it, may not be in the parasha of Nara Basula, or, you know, Basula Shalom Rasa, because she's technically not a Basula. There's a machlokas in the Mishnayis in the first parak, I think Rabbi Meir in the Chacham, whether mukaseis ksubasa mana or ksubasa masayim. So there aren't so many nafkaminas, but she's not like, she's psula kohen gadol. You know, that's one nafkamina, but there aren't so many. Okay. Fine. So then, that's a question of Sula. Asher lo orasa. So here, this is a very interesting expression. Here is where you need to think a little bit about grammar, even though you haven't taken Hebrew yet. It's very important in thinking about the discussion, this three-way machlokes in the Gemara. What does it mean, asher lo orasa? Can someone analyze for me, what is the verb orasa? The root, firstly, that's pretty straightforward. Aleph Resh Sin. I know that I know that most of you are probably surprised to see a sin here, but it's very common. There are a lot of words that you know from rabbinic Hebrew, like Sota, amongst them. There are, I think there are probably 20 examples if you gave me 5 minutes, of which it's a Samach in rabbinic Hebrew, but it's actually a sin in biblical Hebrew. The other good one is Sakim, which only occurs once in Tanakh and Sefer Mishlei, and that's with a sin, even though you've probably never seen Sakim spelled with a sin. Okay, so Oras is Aleph Resh Sin. Okay, now the Binyan.
Is this a passive kala?
No, because it's a Rasi Shah. It's the active is a PL.
Okay.
It's not an internal kala passive. So Orasa, you said, is a Pual. You get the O instead of an U because the Resh doesn't take a Dagesh. And what tense is it?
Avar. Should be Avar.
It is Avar. It has to be Avar.
Unless and Pseudo Jonathan don't see it that way.
Fine. Why in the biblical Hebrew perspective? Now, that by the way, this is not a trivial point. What is the other form you could have gotten here in theory that would have made sense as well? But Sher lo me'orasa. Actually, it wouldn't have been lo me'orasa. It would be ena me'orasa, because I know in modern Hebrew they say lo yodea, but it's technically wrong. It's ein yodea, because a participle or a hoveh takes ein to negate. A verb, a perfect and past tense takes lo. But nonetheless, today they say lo yodea. But it would have been ein asher einam orasa. Okay. Now, what difference does it make for all intents and purposes? What nafkamina is it when the Torah said asher einam orasa, asher lo orasa? Yeah.
She was orasa, that she was either divorced or.
Excellent. What happens if a woman had a resent and then the husband died or divorced her, which preserves one very important component, that she's still a basula? What's the din if she was orasa but not anymore, which is inam orasa but it was orasa? So that's a machlokas Rabbi Yosef HaGalili and two different versions of Rabbi Akiva. So that's really an important issue that we have to talk about. Rashbam just writes here, asher lo orasa she'im orasa chayiv skila k'dechsin mishnah Torah. He's skirting the issue, and in fact I suspect he's subverting one reading Chazal on this, Kedarka Bakodesh, by stating that it doesn't matter what happened in the past. It's really asher lo orasa is because if orasa, she's chayiv skila. What does that mean? It doesn't mean if orasa, she's chayiv skila. It's if me'orasa. If she's me'orasa now, she's chayiv skila. So the Rashbam sort of pulls it out from under discussion. In other words, there's nothing you can tell from the pasuk about what happens if she had Arison and then was divorced or widowed, Mino Arison. Okay.
Sorry, you said grammatically, Asher lo orasa means that.
She hadn't had Arison. Which could imply that if she ever. Right, correct, ever. Thank you. That's the best word to put it. Okay. Even though I don't like to stop in the middle of the pasuk, I will stop in the middle of this pasuk. You know, the Tsar Gadol Hitrili Rebbe, you know, lifts up Suke for the Tinoko Shabes Rabban, so I'll treat you for these purposes, Tinoko Shabes Rabban. Forgive me. I wanted to just talk about one thing before we stop, which is coming back to the issue of time. It's relevant to all of you, but especially if it's your first time in yeshiva and first time in sort of full program, which is very challenging. There is a din that's known as pigul. Pigul means that if I shech the karban, or I do any of the four major avodas of a karban, and I have in mind when I'm doing it to eat from the flesh, to give one example, chutz lizmano, outside of the time the Torah allows, or chutz limkomo, outside of the place that the Torah prescribes to the karban is no good. And it, even and you're not allowed to eat it even within the time of in the place. What happens if you then eat from it? So if the karban was what we call chutz limkomo, sometimes called pigel chutz limkomo, then you're chayav malchus for eating from it. But if it's chutz lizmano, if you had in mind to eat it chutz lizmano when you did it, then you're chayav kares for eating it. Why the difference? You did the exact same thing. You shechted the karban. You had a bad machshava. You had bad thoughts when you did it. Incorrect thoughts. Why the difference? I think that the answer is the following. There are two kinds of kedushas that we recognize in halacha. One is kedushas makom, and one is kedushas man. They're both very important. But I think that the message that the Torah is giving here is that kedushas man is even more important. Time is the one thing that you can't get any more of. When it passes, it's gone. We each have, you know, a fixed lifespan upon the earth, whatever that should be. It should be long for all of us. But you can't get back time that you lost. And if you waste time, more of it's not coming. Those of you who have been in Yeshiva College know already that when you get to finals and midterms, you appreciate that the time that you wasted early in the semester that could have been done preparing in advance is time that you wish you had back. But you're not going to get it back, and at that time, it's too late. So I encourage you all to plan very carefully from the outset. I know that some of you who've been through this many times start the semester with the best of intentions, and somehow, you know, things slip and you don't do the work when you should do it, so then comes midterms, comes final, and you're piled under. So I encourage you very, very strongly to pay attention to that. But along with that, I want to make a request. I've never made this request before, but I want to give you homework. I don't wish to see it, but I implore you, I beg you to do it. You know, when people come to diet, to lose weight, so they've actually discovered this one technique, the most effective technique is not a particular diet of food. It's not a particular, you know, the latest fad or anything else or measure or any types of the newest thing. Instead, they found that if people keep a food log, it's the most effective method of dieting. Food log is that everything you eat, you record what you ate and how much you ate. And the reason for that is because we as human beings, thank God, actually, have a remarkable capability of forgetting and of deluding ourselves. If we didn't, none of us could live with ourselves. But that comes with a downside, which is that we delude ourselves. So people think they're dieting, and they think they're restricting their caloric intake, and then they're really not, because they cheat here, and they cheat there, and they nibble here, and a bite there, and a nibble here, and a bite there, and all of a sudden they don't realize that they ate an extra 1,000 calories that day. But when you keep a food log, so what it says, you know exactly, every time you go to eat, so it makes you think twice, and also it gives you a reality check. You see at the end of the day, at the end of the week, what exactly you ate. So, you know, sometimes the Bali Musar speak about making a cheshbon on nefesh on zman. And I make the following requests for people, which is for a week, especially as Yom and Milroim are coming, so it's an appropriate time to tshuva. At the end of the day, sit down and write out a time, you don't have to during the middle of the day, take 5 minutes to write out a time log exactly what you did. You know, you went to class, you were learning, how much time you spent on Facebook and how much time you spent surfing the web. And I mentioned those two specifically because I think some of you know cognitively, but sometimes have trouble absorbing how much of a time waste, you know, how much you get pulled in to these things. It's true for everybody. It's not just true for students. But you have even less time to waste than some. You have less of a luxury of wasting time than your peers do on secular college campuses, or people who are not in Yeshiva College and who are in different settings. None of us really have the luxury of wasting time, but you have even less so. And so I think that I ask all of you to take it for a week, to just sort of keep a time log, and see where you spent your time doing what activities. I'm not interested in seeing it. I'm not going to ask you about it. But I think for yourselves, it's a very, very powerful tool. And it's something that you might find that has an impact upon how you spend time. But putting that specific aspect aside, I think as we begin the Nuzman, I think we need to be very mindful of how we spend our time, because there really is an extremely limited amount of it. You know, and as the Mishnah Abba says, Hayom Katzar of Hamalacha Meruba, and the Balabayas here is Dochik. So a chacham is a person who's roes anolad. So you're starting with a tabula rasa. You're starting with a blank slate now. So write well.